Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the CDH Conversations podcast, where we'll be speaking on the redundancy process in Kenya. My name is Kevin Kipchirchir, a trainee advocate at CDH Kenya. Joining me today is Christine Mugenyu, a senior associate at CDH Kenya in the Dispute Resolution and Employment Law Department. Welcome, Christine.
Thank you.
So, Christine, redundancy is common among employers who seek to restructure their businesses, and it's been noted that it is one of the ways of terminating a contract of employment other than through dismissal or retirement. The definition of retrenchment being the loss of employment, occupation, job or career by involuntary means through no fault of the employee, but at the initiative of the employer, where the services of an employee are superfluous, and the practices commonly known as abolition of office, job or occupation, and the loss of employment. However, Christine, you will note, it is by no means a get-out-of-jail-for-free card for employers. There is a process to be followed and substantive safeguards to be adhered to. In this podcast, we analyze the requirements for redundancy in Kenya and more particularly highlight the recent employment court determination in Tom Kimaru versus the Nairobi Securities Exchange. This brings me to my first question. Christine, what are some of the circumstances that would force an employer to declare redundancy?
That's a very good question, Kevin. So, Kevin, as you have stated, primarily redundancy occurs where the loss of employment, occupation, job or career is by involuntary means, which means that it is at no fault of the employee and it is at the initiative of the employer. So the first thing is that we must highlight first the principle that courts will generally not interfere with an employer's prerogative on how they conduct and run their business. This also includes instances where an employer has to terminate the employment of its employees on account of redundancy. This position has been upheld by the courts in Kenya, and particularly in the case of Jane Halachi versus Oxford University Press, where the court held that although not expressly defined in the Employment Act, reorganization is a fair reason for termination. So to answer your question, Kevin, some of the reasons why an employer can declare redundancy are, number one, the company's inability to sustain its employees' wages and salaries. Number two, the employee's skill becoming superfluous to the company's needs, meaning that the company no longer needs the employee's specific skill set. And also it can come about when there's a closure of business, and also where, for example, the company is either merged with another or is acquired by another company.
Thank you, Christine, for opening up the discussion with those brilliant responses. So therefore, we would assume that this framework of redundancy occurs within a larger framework. And therefore, what is this framework, particularly in Kenya?
Yes. So redundancies are governed by Article 41 of the Constitution of Kenya, 2010, the Employment Act, and also the Labor Relations Act. And Section 40 of the Employment Act particularly provides for termination on account of redundancy and sets out the process that must be followed.
And so therefore, Christine, bearing in mind the legal framework you just outlined, I think it would just be best to lay out the process for redundancy that is reflected in Section 40 of the Employment Act. And this begins with, before terminating employees on account of redundancy, there must be issuance of notices to the employees. So notice to the employees who might be affected by the intended redundancy. And in a nutshell, the steps are generally five to be followed in a redundancy. First is the issuance of 1 month's notice of intended redundancy to employees or to their trade union where they are unionized employees. Then secondly, issuance of 1 month's notice of intended redundancy to the labor officer of the area within which the employees are working. And these run simultaneously. So the notice to the employees and the notice to the labor officer to be dispatched together. Then thirdly, after the notices, there must be consultation with employees and any other relevant stakeholders, and these might involve trade unions or relevant government agencies. And fourthly, issuance of notice of redundancy, retention or new appointment to affected employees. So as a result of the consultation, if it culminates in a redundancy, a notice of redundancy to the affected employees. If it culminates in a retention or reappointment on different terms, a notice to that effect. And then lastly, we have the issuance of a certificate of service to employees affected by redundancy. And concomitant with the issuance of a certificate of service, we note The employee being made redundant must be paid their dues, which we will later on discuss as the podcast goes on. It is also recommended, as a matter of practice, that the employees be required to sign a letter confirming that they have no outstanding claims. And also, as we go on with the podcast, we will note that this letter, or what is called a discharge voucher or a separation agreement, would be important as the courts normally determine disputes arising from redundancy. Then also, lastly, as an issue of practice, it is recommended that the employer issues a notice to the labor officer confirming the redundancy. So, in a nutshell, Christine, we note that there is the requirement for notices and consultations throughout the process. So, Christine, what is the requirement for these notices? Are there any specific issues to be covered?
Yes, Kevin, there are issues to be covered in the notices. So, for one, the notice of intended redundancy should first of all include the reasons for the redundancy and the extent of the redundancy. And this notice should be not less than 1 month. And moreover, this notice period of 1 month cannot be paid off in lieu. This means that an employer cannot opt not to issue this notice and pay the employees. It must be issued. If the employee is unionized, the notification should also be served on the trade union. And if the employee is not unionized, the notice should be served directly on the employee. Then the other notice is the notice of intended redundancy to the labor officer, which will notify the labor officer of the intended redundancy and shall be served not less than 1 month prior to the intended redundancy and termination of the employee's contract. On this point, Kevin, the ELRC, or the Employment Court in Kenya, has made some pointers on what the notices should cover. Could you highlight what the case that we are discussing today is about?
Yes, you'll notice that we will be covering Tom Kimaru versus the Nairobi Securities Exchange. And in this case, a classic case of redundancy, there were 7 claimants who were employees of the Nairobi Securities Exchange from various dates till their termination through redundancy. That was on account of a restructuring process. The decision to restructure by the NSC followed a decision by the board aimed at aligning the NSC with business needs to eliminate overlaps within its structure and to improve performance. They were served with notices of redundancy dated the 27th of February 2019, indicating that their services would be terminated on the 31st of March of the same year. The Labour Office was also notified, and the NSC contemplated that this amounted to 1 month redundancy notice in accordance with Section 41B of the Employment Act. The claimants in the case claimed that this was a termination notice, the redundancy decision having already been made. And the respondent averred, of course, the opposite, that this was a redundancy notice and that the decision to merge led to some of the positions being eliminated and some roles being done away with. And this affected some employees, including the claimants. Each of the claimants was paid redundancy dues, and 5 of the claimants in the case had signed discharge vouchers. So those will be some of the facts of the case, Christine.
So while you were going through the decision, I've noted some important prudential pointers that I would like you to talk about.
Precisely, Christine. I think the ELRC really came strongly to make some jurisprudential developments on the case. And firstly, the ELRC determined that for a redundancy process to be valid, 2 critical things must be examined. So firstly, whether there was a valid reason to declare the redundancy, and secondly, whether fair procedure was followed. And on these 2 points, the ELRC determined that for it to uphold the reason for redundancy, the employer must state the operational requirement that necessitated the process and prove that the need was in fact obtaining at the time of the decision. And in this case, the Nairobi Securities Exchange alleged that it was reorganizing its structure in order to optimize performances, and these involved the merger of certain departments, the depletion of certain roles, and the creation of new departments. However, the court found that out of the 7 positions that were declared redundant, 2 of them had not been earmarked for removal, and therefore the NSC's testimony was insufficient to prove that 2 more were lost as a result of the restructuring process. That just goes to show the requirement for reason to declare the redundancy. The court also clarified that a redundancy notice must address the reasons and the extent of the redundancy, with the extent of redundancy speaking to the number of employees that are likely to be affected by the redundancy. And Christine, you had mentioned this point of the notice speaking to extent and the reasons. The court found that since the notice did not indicate the extent of the redundancy, the process was flaunted. And notably, previous jurisprudence on the matter has never provided that the notice must indicate the number of employees to be affected by the redundancy. However, the employment court in Tom Kimaru versus the Nairobi Securities Exchange seems to add another requirement to notices issued to the labor office and to the employees, that is the extent of redundancy. And in this case, you must indicate the number of the employees that you speculate will be affected. So since this is a High Court determination, Christine, it remains to be seen whether the Court of Appeal will maintain this train of thought. As things stand, the appellate determinations in cases such as Kenya Airways and Cargill Kenya override the decision of the ELRC. However, as good practice, of course, it may be necessary for employers to specify in numbers the extent of their intended redundancies. So, moreover, on what would be the third limb, the claimants had challenged the selection process that informed the employees to be affected. And the court relied on Section 41C of the Employment Act on the criteria of seniority, skill, and ability. So in this case, the court found that the Nairobi Securities Exchange did not tender any evidence to demonstrate its selection criteria. And the court recognized that the primary criterion is the first in, last out principle, but noted that employers may deviate from these only to the extent contemplated in Section 41C above.
Thank you, Kevin. As we note, the court did pronounce itself on the contents of the notices and also as well as on the selection process.
Yes, perhaps, Christine, you can let us know what the generally acceptable selection criteria is and in light of this new jurisprudence.
So an employer is required to consider seniority in time, skill, ability and reliability of the employees when determining who should be declared redundant. And the Employment Act actually provides a non-exhaustive list of objective criteria that an employer should observe. And this includes, but is not limited to, the, as you've alluded to, Kevin, the last in, first out principle, that is LIFO, any disciplinary issues which have not been resolved with warnings documented in the employee's file. The third one is any performance failures, and the fourth one is the skills and required capabilities for the existing or new positions. So in light of the Tom Kimaru case, the Employment Court recognized that the primary criteria is the first in, last out principle, but noted that employers may deviate from this only to the extent contemplated in Section 41C of the Employment Act, which could be, for example, where an employer's objective is to employ modern technology to carry out his business, which can only be done by the last employees to be employed, and who, according to the last in, first out principle, should be first to exit, but actually the ones with the technological know-how that the employer requires.
That's fascinating, Christine. So notices form just one aspect of the redundancy process, don't they? And consultations form the other limb of the redundancy process. So would you like to shed light to our listeners what the parameters for the consultation are?
Yes, thank you, Kevin. So in essence, consultation is an essential part of the redundancy process and ensures that there is substantive fairness. An employer should know with certainty the employees that will be made redundant at this stage. An objective selection criteria should be strictly observed to ensure fairness. And as we had earlier discussed, it is important to note that the consultation process should be run for a minimum of 1 month. Further, that the consultation process may differ if the redundancy is a large one or a small one. For instance, a town hall meeting may be held with employees if the redundancy is a large one. If it is a small one, then you can have one-on-one or individual consultations. And the employer should ensure that it carries out the process as fair as possible and that all mitigating factors are taken into consideration. And just to highlight one of the cases that talks a lot about consultations in redundancy is the court in Kenya Airways Limited versus Aviation and Allied Workers Union, Kenya and three others, where the court held that consultation is a must under the principle of fair play. And consultation also gives an opportunity for other avenues to be considered to avert or to minimize the adverse effects of termination on account of redundancy. And these consultations must not be cosmetic, that they must be a reality and not a charade. And all stakeholders must be taken into account during the period of consultations.
And I think it's a good thing that you close out with the Court of Appeals determination in Kenya Airways Limited and the issue of consultation giving rise to opportunity for other avenues to be considered. And that leads me to my next question, Christine. Are employers allowed to offer employees a golden handshake instead of a retrenchment? Perhaps you can enlighten our listeners on what a golden handshake would be in this case.
Yes, Kevin. So employers are permitted to offer employees voluntary severance packages or what others term as early retirement packages as an alternative to redundancy. The only rider with this is that it must be permitted in the employer's HR policies, and the employee must willingly apply for the voluntary severance package or the early retirement in the term set out by the employer. So this is normally regarded as a new agreement, which is between the employee and the employer. And in particular, the Court of Appeal in National Bank of Kenya Limited versus HBN 103 others held that the terms of a voluntary severance package and or early retirement are valid as long as they are voluntarily accepted by an employee. And Kevin, you will note, or we will note, that in the employment court in the Tom Kimaru case considered also discharge vouchers and found that while a voucher does not absolve the court from determining the fairness of a termination, where it is shown that the voucher was entered into freely, it constitutes a complete contract.
Thank you, Christine. And I think just for the sake of completeness, we'll be coming back to the issue of discharge vouchers and their net effect when we'll be considering the issue of payment of severance packages. So, Christine, after all relevant notices have been sent out, consultation has been conducted, and the decision to retrench an employee has been arrived at, what is the process that follows and what is the severance package, if any?
So a notice of redundancy or a notice of new appointment or a notice of retention is normally issued to the affected employees. Those are the employees whose positions have been determined. And this particular notice should notify either one, the employee has been retained in the initial position with some adjustments, for example, a reduction in salary. Number two, whether the employee has been transferred to a new position. And number three, whether the employee has been made redundant. And this notice in particular, which declares an employee redundant, should also set out the heads of the terminal dues payable upon termination. So over and above this, an employee is entitled to severance pay on redundancy at the rate of a minimum of 15 days for each year of service completed. And in addition to the severance pay, an employer is required to pay an employee, number one, their basic salary up to the last day of employment, any accrued leave days in cash, and where applicable, payment in lieu of notice, that is, under the Employment Act, the minimum notice period is 30 days. However, this will depend on the notice period as set out in the employee's contract. And finally, an employer can pay out any benefits provided for under the employment contract, which may include but not be limited to airtime allowance, car allowance, and any entitled bonus.
So yes, our time to discuss this vouchers came sooner than we expected. And the Employment Court in Tom Kimaru made certain determinations with respect to the binding nature of discharge vouchers. And I think you had touched on it earlier on, Christine. So you might want to just explain generally what it is and their net effect.
Okay. So discharge vouchers are commonly used, especially at the time of separation with the employee after redundancy. And these are basically settlement agreements which are entered into between employers and the employees who are declared redundant, in that they set out that the employee relinquishes any claims that they have against the employer in consideration for the severance package that they receive. So in this particular case, then Nairobi Securities Exchange had offered the discharge vouchers to employees that were signed by some of the claimants, and the NSC claimed that they had paid them terminal dues, while the claimants had alleged that they signed their vouchers under undue influence. The court found that there was no undue influence since they had signed the vouchers after being paid their dues. Moreover, the employment court determined that the vouchers constituted a bar binding the claimants from seeking further redress on matters covered by the vouchers. The court found that while the voucher does not absolve the court from determining the fairness of a termination, where it is shown that the voucher was entered into freely, it constitutes a complete contract and is binding. So consequently, the court found that its hands were tied in the matter of compensation for the individuals who signed the discharge vouchers.
Yes, I think that segue leads us then to the question of remedies available by the employment court in the instance of an unlawful or an unfair redundancy, and if these remedies are similar for remedies awardable for any other unlawful termination.
So yes, Kevin, so the Act has provided for the remedies that are available where an employer, for example, flouts the process or does not carry out the redundancy in accordance with the law. And some of these remedies are, number one, the employee will receive the wages which the employee would have earned had the employee been given the period of notice to which he was entitled to, or the equivalent of at most 12 months' wages or salary. And if the labor officer deems the dismissal to have been unfair, the labor officer may order either reinstatement or re-employment. And if an employee alleges and proves discrimination tied to the whole redundancy process, then their compensation tends to be more.
Okay, so we are drawing close to the end of our podcast, and we just seek to pick some nuggets or best practice advice from Christine. Based on your years of experience advising companies, Christine, what would be your three best practices going forward?
Thank you, Kevin. So the three best practices that we would advise our clients to employ when carrying out redundancies are, number one, the reasons for the redundancy. As you have stated before, for a redundancy to be declared lawful, the reasons for it must be valid. And an employer must always state the operational requirement that necessitated the redundancy process and prove that there was a need to actually carrying out the redundancy. Number two is that an employer must follow the process for redundancy as set out in Section 40 of the Employment Act. And this includes adhering to the issuance of the requisite notices, holding consultations, and also ensuring that they pay out the severance package in accordance with the law. Then number three, we are also now encouraging the use of discharge vouchers. As we have seen from the Tom Kimaru case, the court upholds the binding nature of discharge vouchers where no duress or fraud is pleaded by an employee. So this might provide extra comfort to employers who would like to minimize the risk of subsequent litigation or opening up of the issue of severance packages. So, well, there you have it. We've come to the end of our podcast. So in case of any further questions or queries that you may have regarding employment and in particular redundancy in Kenya, please feel free to contact us here at CDH Kenya.
The views and information expressed are those of the contributors at the time of publication and do not necessarily present those of the firm. All content is provided for general purposes only and does not constitute legal advice. We make no representations, warranties, or guarantees, whether expressed or implied, that the content on our podcast is accurate, complete, up-to-date, or reflects the current law. We accept no responsibility for any loss or damage, whether direct or consequential, arising from reliance on the information which is presented here.